We'll be studying the powers that are in place during the tribulation period. And since we're at a breaking point in the action of the judgments, we're going to go back and look at the powers. And what we're going to do is look at two sections in Daniel to do that. Remember, chapter 10 now begins a break in the action. And the first one, we've had one of these before. The first one was back in chapter 7, and it talked about salvation during the tribulation period. Remember, and it told that there will be saved Jews. Look back at chapter 7 and verse 4, for example. We just looked at these last hours, the 144,000 Jews that were sealed at the beginning of the tribulation period. It says, "And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel." So they will be evangelizing, and there will be Jews, Israelites saved during the tribulation. There will also be Gentiles saved. Verse 9 through 17 of chapter 7 deals with the Gentiles. Look at verse 9. It says, "After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could count, from every nation, and all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands. And they cry out with a loud voice, saying, Salvation to our God, who sits on the throne, and to the Lamb." So those are the Gentiles who are saved during the tribulation. And that's what chapter 7 was all about. And it was a break in the action, a parenthetical chapter, if you want to call it that. Now, Revelation chapter 9 and verse 12 said that it's talking about the woe judgments. It says, "The first woe is past, and behold, two woes are still coming after these things." Now, last hour we looked at the sixth woe, or sixth trumpet, the second woe. And that was the army from the east, the 200 million man army. And we looked at that. Now, in chapter 10, we're going to have a break, and it'll be picked up back at chapter 11 and verse 14. Look at that verse. Chapter 11 and verse 14 says, "The second woe is past. Behold, the third woe is coming quickly." So we have this section in between there from 10:1 to 11:13 that's talking about something else. It's a break in the action of the judgments. And what it's going to talk about is the powers that are in play during the tribulation period. And we're going to go back and do some background on that this morning. So this section is parenthetical. And the purpose of those interruptions, parenthetical, by the way, does not mean it's unimportant. It's very important. What these passages do are give us information so we can put the whole picture together. You know, we needed that information on salvation during the tribulation, because we started out studying the judgments and we think, oh my gosh, what's a person to do? Will there be salvation available during the tribulation? And chapter 7 gave us that background. Yes, there will be. And there will be multitudes saved. Now, this section will introduce a strong angel. It introduces the two witnesses. And now, this morning, we're going to do some background work on the 10 kings or the 10 nation confederacy that will be in power under the command of the Antichrist in the tribulation. So that's what the purpose of this class is, the 10 nation confederacy. And I'm sure if you've studied any of Revelation or prophecy at all, you've heard of that 10 nation confederacy. And we're going to look at the passages that talk about that so we can see where that idea comes from. Now, just by way of background, remember when we studied the 70 weeks in Daniel chapter 9, 24 through 27, we said that that was a world history from a Jewish perspective. It was looking forward through time, and it was in a Jewish perspective. And we noted that in that prophecy, there was a seven-year period that was not yet accounted for. And it's still future. It's still future to us. It's called the tribulation period. It begins as soon as the church is raptured and leaves the earth. So now, in Daniel chapter 2 and chapter 7, what we'll look at is world history from a Gentile perspective. That chapter 9 was from a Jewish perspective, and chapter 2 and 7 are from a Gentile perspective, or non-Jewish. A Gentile is everybody but the Jews. And we're going to see that Daniel chapter 2 and chapter 7, the verses that we're going to read out of them, tell exactly the same story. Now, why would it be put twice? Well, it's going to be from a little different perspective. Daniel chapter 2 tells the story from man's perspective. And when Nebuchadnezzar has a dream and a vision, that vision represents the future, his future. Now, some of it will be past in our eyes, and some of it future. But to Nebuchadnezzar, it was all in the future. And he sees the future as a beautiful image, a beautiful statue with a head of gold and arms and shoulders of silver, and very beautiful. Now, Daniel chapter 7, it's not Nebuchadnezzar who has the vision, it's Daniel himself who has the vision. Now, Daniel's a believer, not only a believer, but he's in fellowship with God, and his vision sees this same future, only he sees it as wild animals. So you see the difference in perspective from God's view of man's political future and man's view. Man sees political future as beautiful. God sees it as a bunch of wild animals. And that's why it's given twice, two different perspectives that we'll look at. So first let's look at Nebuchadnezzar's image in Daniel chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar is a Gentile, and we get a little background in chapter 1 of Daniel. Verse 1 dates the book of Daniel. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So we have a date. The third year of the reign of Jehoiakim. That's 605 B.C. We can date that. Now, modern scholars don't like that date because it puts it too far back. Modern scholars like to say, well, Daniel couldn't have known what was going to happen in the future. And some of his prophecies have already been fulfilled. The prophecy of Antiochus Epiphanes, for example, has already been fulfilled to the exact detail. So the scholars say, well, Daniel must have been written after that happened, and that was in the interdispensational time. So Daniel has to be newer than it says here. And I remember once I was in a Bible study, and there was a girl there, and the teacher was talking about this. And he was a friend of mine. And the girl said, well, what difference does it really make when Daniel was written? You know, we can still read it and get our, you know, spiritual significance about it, even if it wasn't written in 605 B.C. And his answer was, well, if Daniel lied about the date he wrote the book, how can we believe anything he said? You can't believe, you know, if you're going to say he lied about that, why on earth would you want to study the book? And that's the position I take. I mean, we have a date for this book, and that date is given, and I take it that's when it was written. Now, verse 2 through 7 gives us a little background about Daniel himself. Let's read those. Daniel 1 in verse 2 says, "The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought vessels into the treasury of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of the officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had the ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered them to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among them, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah." Okay, so Daniel was one of the Jewish youths that was taken from Jerusalem to Nebuchadnezzar. And he was going to be teach these guys the ways of the Chaldeans. And we're going to see in a minute that Chaldean is kind of a general term. It means a smart guy, really. So that's where we are now. Daniel is one of the wise men in Nebuchadnezzar, the Gentiles' court, because Nebuchadnezzar defeated Israel. And Daniel is now a captive, and he's serving in the court of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Look at verse 1. It says, "Now in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him." So what does he do about this? He's having these dreams, and he can't sleep, and his spirit is troubled. What he does is he demands that the scholars of his day interpret the dream. Verse 2, "Then the king gave orders to call in the magicians, the conjurers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. The king said to them, 'I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream.'" Now, just a note here, as I said before, the term Chaldean is a generic term for a smart person. Remember when we studied Corinthians? The Corinthians were so immoral that the Greek word Corinthiazo, which was the name of the town, meant to be immoral. And that's the same thing here. The Chaldeans were so noted for their wisdom that Chaldean just became a kind of a generic term for a smart person. So that's who he's calling in. He's calling in all of his wise men, everybody who would have a shot at interpreting his dream. You know, these Chaldeans, and they weren't. You know, we think of people, especially in the Old Testament, as being, oh, they're pre-scientific, they're dumb, they didn't really know much. You know, the Chaldeans computed the length of the solar year to within a half an hour of what modern science says it is. In fact, 26 minutes and 55 seconds. So they're no dummies. I mean, think of the instrumentation they had. And they computed the length of the solar year within a half an hour of what we know it is today with all our instrumentation and gizmos. The king knows that. And the king, he's not a dummy. King Nebuchadnezzar was a smart man. And what he does is he refuses to reveal what the dream is to these guys. He's telling them to first tell him what the dream was and then to interpret it. So in other words, he wants verification. Look at verse 9. Well, start at verse 8. It says, "The king replied, 'I know for certain that you are bargaining for time, inasmuch as you have seen that the command is from me is firm, that if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation. Fair request, isn't it? He says, if you guys are so smart, tell me what the dream was first and then tell me the interpretation. I want to insert a note here. And this is fascinating. You know, the Bible is such an amazing book, and it just never ceases to amaze me, even after studying it for as many years as I have. But, and this one always blows me away. If you're reading Daniel in the Hebrew Old Testament, when you get to Daniel chapter 2 and verse 4, the language changes. It changes from Hebrew to Aramaic, Gentile language. It goes all the way over to 728 in Aramaic. Why is that? Because we're talking from a Gentile perspective now. Nebuchadnezzar's dream, Daniel's vision, they're going to be about the future in terms of Gentile nations. What an amazing book. It even changes the language to show you that, hey, there's a change here. You know, we're talking about Gentiles now. Not Jews. Fascinating. So now when we get down to verse 10 and 11, the organized religion of Nebuchadnezzar's day just kind of throws in the towel. They admit defeat. Verse 10 says, the Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who could declare the matter. For the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician or conjurer or Chaldean. So they take the tack of organized religion and they say, it's your fault because you ask us to do something that is impossible. Verse 11, he says, moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there is no one else who could declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. So they blame the king for asking something that they can't answer, and the king gets a little frustrated here. His response to these guys is, kill them all. Verse 12 says, because of this, the king became indignant and very furious and gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. Not just the ones he was talking to, everybody. He says, okay, I've had enough with you guys. You say you're wise men, you say you're a magician, yet you can't tell me the dream. So, kill them all. I don't need these guys. You know, they're a waste of good skin. So they come to kill Daniel, because Daniel was one of the wise men, wasn't he? We have that in verse 13 through 20. And what Daniel does is he's going to buy a little time, and then he's going to ask God for the interpretation and for the dream itself. Verse 13 says, so the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them. Then Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He said to Arioch, the king's commander, for what reason is the decree from the king so urgent? Then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. Then Daniel went to his house and informed his friends Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah about the matter, so that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So he asked the king for a little time, says, I'm going to go talk to God about it and see what he says. So God responds by revealing the dream and its interpretation to them. Verse 19, then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven, So Daniel gives credit where it's due here. In verse 21, it says, it is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power. Even now you have made known to me what we requested of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter. Now in verse 24 through 30, Daniel gets an audience with the king and tells him exactly who it was who interpreted the dream. And here too, he's giving credit where credit's due. He doesn't come to the king and said, hey, I know what it means now. I figured it out. What does he say? He says, therefore, Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king. Then Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows, I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king. The king said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? And Daniel answered before the king and said, as for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the visions in your mind while on your bed. So he says, God in heaven knows what your dream was and what it means. So the king's dream starts at verse 31. It says, you, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. And the wind was carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So Daniel told the king what his dream was. So that's got to be pretty impressive to the king. And this statue, now, we'll get to the interpretation. The statue represents a series of earthly kingdoms. And this series follows in a progression. Now, the word kingdom occurs 9 times in these verses, 36 through 34. There's no mistake here. This is talking about kingdoms. Kingdoms that will come after Nebuchadnezzar and after Daniel. And there's 2 things that we need to remember about these kingdoms. Because people interpret these kingdoms in all kinds of crazy ways. But if you remember these 2 things, and they're in the text, then you'll see it's very, very easy to interpret. First, there's a definite sequence. Look at verse 39 and 40. It says, after you, there will arise another kingdom, inferior to you. It says, after you. And then verse 40, then there will be a fourth kingdom. You see, there's a progression. And they have to follow in that specific progression. Second thing to remember is all of these kingdoms are worldwide, the known worldwide. And both of these things, like each kingdom, if you rearrange the kingdoms, you destroy the prophecy because it has to be in sequence and each of them have to be worldwide. So the interpretation, we have an advantage over Daniel or Nebuchadnezzar because we live a long time after they did. And what they were looking at was all in the future to them. We can look backwards at most of it. Not all of it, but most of it. And we can just look in our history textbooks and interpret the dream. Because the first kingdom is the head of gold, and that's Babylon. Look at verse 36. It says, "This was a dream. Now we will tell its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand." You see the worldwide nature of this? "And has caused you to rule over them all." Now here is the starting point of this prophecy. You are the head of gold. So Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian kingdom was the head of gold. And we can date that. It's B.C. 606 through 538. That was the Babylonian Empire. Now, the second kingdom, look at verse 32 when he's describing the statue. It says, "The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver." So the next is the breast and arms of silver. Now, if we look back in our history books and we look at the Babylonian Empire, we can read who conquered the Babylonian Empire. What was the next world empire after the Babylonians? Well, it was the Medo-Persian Empire. The Medes and the Persians. It was inferior to Babylon, and he says that in verse 39, "After you there will arise another kingdom inferior to you." So they're inferior. Why were they inferior? Well, they were divided, the Medes and the Persians. And in fact, the Persians dominated this alliance, and we'll see more about that in chapter 7. We can date that too, B.C. 538 to 331. The next kingdom, go back up to 32 again. So we have the head of statue, that's Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, fine gold. Its breast and its arms of silver, that's the Medo-Persian Empire. Its belly and thighs of bronze. So we're at the belly and thighs of bronze, and we look down at the end of verse 39. It says, "Then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth." Now we look back in our history textbooks, and again, all the earth. So the belly and thighs of bronze were Greece. That's B.C. 331 to 31. You know, Alexander the Great, who was the leader of Greece during the short span of his life, conquered the entire known world by the time he was 30 years old. Can you imagine that? He died at 33. He died of extreme debauchery, is the polite way to put that. He probably got bored. I mean, what are you going to do after you conquer the world, you know, and you're 30 years old? Well, so that's the next kingdom. Again, we can follow these in our history books. Now, the fourth kingdom, and that's verse 40 through 45, that one we have to look at a little bit. Look at verse 40. It says, "Then there will be a fourth kingdom, as strong as iron." And remember back in 32 or 33, "its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay." This is talking about the Roman Empire. "Then there will be a fourth kingdom, as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So, like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. In that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom. but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with the common clay. As the toes and the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with the common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. The fourth kingdom, the legs and the feet, were again historically who defeated the Greece, the Empire of Greece. It was Rome. So we have the Roman Empire. And that, in Daniel's vision, represents B.C. 31 down to today, if you want to call it that. Rome lost world dominion, but their influence is still seen everywhere in the Western civilization. So the thing we need to note about this passage is that verse 40 to us is in the past. That has already taken place. Verse 41 is in the future. It's the 10-nation confederacy. You know, the Old Testament writers frequently skip over the church age, and that's exactly what he's doing here. The Roman Empire was in power when Christ was crucified. He's skipping over the church age now, and he's saying that Rome will be in power during the tribulation, only it will be 10 different, the 10 toes will be 10 different nations, and they will form a confederacy. Now, I'm going to show you why I say this. I didn't make this up just to fit into my theology. I'll show you where the Bible says that. Look at Isaiah chapter 9. In Isaiah 9, I just wanted to show you another example of where the Old Testament writers would just skip the church age entirely. Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6, it says, "For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders." Wait a minute. It's talking about the first advent. A child will be born, a son will be given to us, and that he's going to rule. The government will rest on his shoulders. Has that happened? Is the government resting on the shoulders of Christ now? Are we in the millennial kingdom, in other words? No. That verse skips the whole church age. A child will be born, and he's going to have the government on his shoulders. There's a lot in between there. And that's exactly what Daniel's doing in Daniel chapter 2. So flip back to Daniel chapter 2, and we'll see why I say this. Because in verse 41 it says, "In that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom." So there's the 10 toes represent 10 kingdoms. "But it will have the toughness of iron," and so forth and so on. And in verse 44, it says, "In the days of those kings," what kings? The 10 toes kings. What's going to happen in the days of those toes? "The God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed." So how do I know those toes are future? Because that's when God is going to set up the millennial kingdom. He hasn't done that yet. Some people will tell you he has, that this is a historical event, that that all happened in the past, and we're living in God's kingdom right now. And I say what I always say when I hear that, boy, am I disappointed. This is God's kingdom. This is what he talks about in the Old Testament as being a nice place. No, it isn't. The kingdom has not been set up yet. It'll be set up in the days of those 10 kings, the 10 nation confederacy. And that they're the ones that will be in power under control of the Antichrist during the tribulation period. So we have a progression here towards division. Babylon, a single unit, very strong. That's why the head of gold. Then the Medo-Persian Empire split in two parts. So it was weaker, and Daniel said that. The second kingdom was weaker. Greece was divided into four parts, and we'll see this in chapter 7, that after the death of Alexander, His family was they were about as bad as him. I think his mother killed his son, and the other two brothers of the son were murdered, and there was nobody to take over the empire. I mean, it was just a bust as far as his family was concerned. And what happened was his generals divided it up into four parts. And we'll see that in chapter 7. So we have a progression towards division. Now Rome, in the end time Rome, will be divided into 10 different kingdoms, the 10 toes of the image. Now calling Rome the two legs probably represents the division of the Roman Empire into the east and west. Now, it was always divided that way, sort of just, I mean, it wasn't official, but there was an eastern Rome and a western Rome. But in AD 395, Emperor Constantine made it official when he divided Rome into the eastern portion and gave it to his son Arcadius, and the western portion he gave it to his son Honorius. So he divided Rome between his two sons. So that would account for the two legs. End time Rome is 10 toes. So that's a 10 nation confederacy. So you see the progression towards division in the future. The interpretation in verse 36 through 45 that we've been looking at talks about the 10 nation confederacy. And it will be strong, and it will be brittle. Verse 42 says, as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong, and part of it will be brittle. Now, the text doesn't say exactly what this is referring to. It could be the strong part talking about the military, and the weak part talking about the governmental, that the countries are divided into military and political, and one is strong and one is weak. It could just mean that the kingdom isn't united. They don't stick together. And that makes a lot of sense, because it's what he says, that clay and iron don't stick together. In verse 43, we get a little hint. It says, and in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men. Now, what does that mean? You know, there's always something that keeps people apart. I mean, we have a big deal going right now about multiculturalism in our country, don't we? We're supposed to accept everybody, no matter what the religion they spout, no matter what they do. Just accept everybody. And we'll all be one big happy country. Is it working? No, it's not working. Because there's always something that keeps people apart. Because people have a sin nature. And that's what all these psychologists that are trying to figure out multiculturalism don't understand. Man has a sin nature. And he's going to hate somebody. He'll find a reason to. You know, when I was in my 20s, being dumb, running around the world with my backpack and my guitar, I found out something. It serves me well now. That I found out that everywhere I went, there was people who hated other people. When I was in Ireland, I was in Belfast, there were actually concrete bunkers where soldiers had machine guns pointing at the streets of Belfast. Why did they do that? Well, because the Irish hate the English. And in Ireland itself, the Catholics hate the Protestants. I mean, it was tough. When I was in Belgium, you know, Belgium, what can you find to hate? Well, part of Belgium speaks French and part speaks German, and they hate each other. If you're a French-speaking Belgian, you hate the German-speaking Belgians. There's nationalism, religion, racism, language, always something people will find to hate about each other. Multiculturalism will never work as long as man has a sin nature. Never going to work. Sorry. And that's not just being radical. That's just a fact. So this 10-nation confederacy is going to be active in the tribulation period. And that, again, how do I know that? Verse 44. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. So I say that because those kings are going to be the kings in power when the Lord returns to set up His kingdom. He's the rock that crushes the toes. So that hasn't happened yet. Now turn to chapter 7. Pardon that graphic. I couldn't find anything better. I know that the fourth beast looks more like Barney than a terrifying beast, but they represent the four kingdoms again. And in Daniel's vision, in chapter 7, we have it dated again. In chapter 7, verse 1, it says, "In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind." So that vision is dated in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. That's about B.C. 553. In other words, we're about 50 years after the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had. Now, in verse 2 sets the scene. It says, "Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea." Now, the four winds of heaven here represent heavenly forces. And they're stirring up the sea. And in this case, it's not the Mediterranean Sea. It's the Sea of Humanity. And that's obvious because it's pointing out that there are heavenly forces behind activities on the earth. They're controlled. So it pictures the unseen forces behind human events. Now, the pattern of Daniel 7 is going to be this. In Daniel chapter 2, we had four kingdoms and then the millennial kingdom. And it was represented, this vision was represented by a beautiful statue. It had a head of gold, and that was Babylon, remember. Chest and arms of silver, Medo-Persia. Belly and thighs of bronze, that was Greece, and legs and feet of iron, and toes mixed with iron and clay, and that was the end time part of the Roman Empire. And the millennial kingdom was the stone cut without hands. Now, in Daniel chapter 7, we're going to see this work exactly the same way, just looking down, or looking forward from their perspective, throughout human history. Only their God's view of it and Daniel's view as a believer is a little different. It's not a beautiful statue. It's vicious animals. Not Barney, but vicious animals. Babylon is going to be characterized like a lion with eagle's wings. And the Medo-Persian Empire is going to be like a bear with three ribs in its mouth. Greece is going to be like a leopard with four wings and four heads. And Rome is going to be the dreadful beast, or some people call it the nondescript beast, because there's nothing in nature that compares with the beast that Daniel sees. And then the millennial kingdom in chapter 7 will be represented by the Son of Man. So you see, we have exactly the same content presented from a little different perspective. Now we're looking at it from God's perspective, and He doesn't see human government as a beautiful image. He sees human government as a bunch of wild animals. So we have the four beasts. First, we have the winged lion in Babylon, and that's the head of gold in chapter 2. Look at verse 4. It says, "The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it." So we have the king of beasts and the king of birds, the lion. And notice in this verse that this king undergoes a complete change of character. It says that Its wings were plucked out, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. So a complete change of character. If you want to see a complete change of character, and I don't know if this is what it's referring to or not, but I kind of have an idea it is, read Daniel chapter 4 sometime, and you'll find that Nebuchadnezzar had a complete change of nature. When he was king of Babylon, he left the castle on all fours eating grass. He went insane. So it was a total change in character. Daniel 4, if you want to read about that. Then we have the bear. In verse 5, it says, "And behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear. And it was raised up on one side, and 3 ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said to it, Arise, devour much meat." Now the bear, this is the arms and breast of silver in Daniel chapter 2. In Nebuchadnezzar's image, a bear is a perfect image of the Medo-Persian Empire, because the Medo-Persian Empire operated on brute strength. They had vast, lumbering armies, very slow, very large. In fact, Xerxes' campaign against Greece was carried out with 2.5 million men, huge armies, huge lumbering armies. Now, it was raised up on one side. That's a reference to the fact that Persia dominated the Medo-Persian Empire. So the sides weren't equal. And the 3 ribs in its mouth represent the 3 kingdoms that were conquered by Persia. There was Lydia in B.C. 546, Babylon in B.C. 539, and Egypt in B.C. 525. Again, just looking back through history books, we can follow this out through history. So we have Babylon, Medo-Persia. The winged leopard represents Greece, and that would be the belly and thighs of bronze in the image in Daniel chapter 2. And this is another perfect illustration. The illustrations are better in Daniel 7 because Alexander's armies were the exact opposite of the Medo-Persian armies. They were huge, slow, lumbering armies. Alexander's were noted for their speed. I mean, he conquered 11,000 miles of territory in 8 years. You know, on foot, basically. That's a lot. And the foreheads of the leopard, verse 6, "After this I kept looking, and behold another one, like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it." And again, the 4 heads, remember, Alexander's Greece was split up by his generals. Ptolemy took Palestine and Egypt, and Seleucus took Syria. Cassander took Greece. Remember when we studied the Thessalonian epistles, we said that the city of Thessalonia was named after Cassander's wife. Now this is the guy who founded Thessalonica. And then there was Lysimachus, who took Asia Minor, which would be what we call probably Turkey today, modern Turkey. So those were the fourfold divisions of the Grecian Empire. Now the dreadful beast in verse 7 and 8. Verse 7 says, "After this I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them. And 3 of the 1st horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts." So we have the dreadful beast, and it's the nondescript beast because there's no animal in the animal kingdom to compare with it. And the 10 horns are the same as the 10 toes in the vision of Daniel chapter 2. So that's the 10 kings ruling in the tribulation. So again, we've gone from the past to the future. When we look at the 10 horns, we're looking at something that is yet future to us. Now the little horn is the Antichrist. Now just make a note here, the little horn in chapter 7 is not the same as the little horn in Daniel chapter 8. That little horn prophecy was fulfilled already, because that one comes from the third kingdom. It comes out of Greece. The prophecy was fulfilled by Antiochus Epiphanes. And he was a type of Antichrist. What he did was he took the temple and he took the altar and knocked it down and put a altar to his God there, and he sacrificed a pig on it. You know what that would do to a Jew? To have a pig sacrificed on the altar? Whoa! So they didn't like this guy very well. Now, he was the type of the Antichrist. And I say that because, well, look at chapter 8 and verse 23. It's talking about the ram and the goat. Those are the two prophecies here, and we don't need to go into the details of those. We'll do that another time. But the ram, in verse 20, which you saw was the two horns, represents the kings of Media and Persia. So that's the Medo-Persian Empire. And the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. And that's where the little horn comes from. And the large horn between his eyes is the first king. The broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. Now, verse 23, in the latter period of their rule, now we're moving ahead. You see, in the latter period, now we're going to the end times. So this is before the end times. And this is what drives the scholars crazy, because his prophecies about Antiochus Epiphanes are so accurate. They don't like that. It bothers them. But that's the dreadful beast. And again, the final kingdom is what? The millennial kingdom. That's when Christ will return to set up his kingdom. Look at verse 13 and 14. Daniel 7:13. It says, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and every man of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away. And his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. So the millennial reign of Christ, again, is the last kingdom. And it merges, notice, with eternity future, because it says it will last forever. So the 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth will merge with the eternal reign of Christ. Now, in verse 19 through 22, Daniel asks for more information about the fourth beast. He sees the importance of that. Verse 19, it says, then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron, its claws of bronze, which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And the meaning of the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, and before which three of them fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth, uttering great boasts, and which was larger in appearance than its associates. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them, until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One. And the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Now, verse 20 talks about the tribulation period. The ten horns were on its head, and the other horn which came up, before which three of them fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth. Eyes represent intelligence. And have you ever heard the Antichrist called Mighty Mouth? Yeah, it comes from here in Revelation also. Has a reference to him boasting and speaking great boasts, uttering great boasts. Verse 22 talks about the millennial kingdom until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one. And the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. So there's the millennial kingdom. Now, verse 26 tells us about the second advent. It says, but the court will set in judgment for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. That's what's going to happen to Antichrist when the Lord returns. Interesting note, when you look at the Bible and you see passages about the Antichrist, almost every time he's mentioned, his destruction is mentioned as well. Almost every time. Just kind of a reminder, don't worry about this guy. He's not in control. And we don't have to worry about him because we'll be gone during the millennial kingdom. Now, next time we'll look at more powers in the tribulation, and we'll look at the scenario, the way the tribulation plays out. We'll kind of give a overview of it. So I'll see you then. Father, thank you for your word. In Christ's name, amen.